Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
How'd you know it was me?
Same caller ID.
Oh, what's it say?
Linda Tripp.
It does?
Yeah.
I have an unpublished phone, the idiot.
The great story here is this vast right-wing conspiracy that has been conspiring against my husband since the day he announced for president.
May of 91, Bill Clinton harassed me on the job and then basically told me, let's keep this between ourselves.
No sexual relationship with this young woman.
There is not a sexual relationship. That is accurate.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, : American Crime Story, : Impeachment, the Vanity Fair podcast dedicated to the FX series American Crime Story Impeachment. This is the final episode of the season, episode 10, titled The Wilderness. I am Katie Rich.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And we have a guest with us this time. Sorry, I'm going to preempt you and reintroduce you, but introduce yourself, special guest.
Julie Miller. I'm so excited to be here to discuss the finale.
Yeah, Julie, you've been like the third leg of our stool covering impeachment this entire season. You've been doing incredible coverage on VF.com and talking to Allison Tripp, Linda Tripp's daughter, who we certainly want to hear about. And we finally got you on the show for the finale, which we're excited to do. And then, speaking of people we finally got on the show, this week's interview is with none other than Monica Lewinsky, a Vanity Fair contributor and a producer on this series and the character at the center of this series, which is, it's a funny interview in which I ask her about Monica in third person because of the way the show depicts her. But we'll get to that later. So before we get into the show, Julie, before we kind of talk to you about your experience of watching it, I did want to read two emails that we got, really delightful emails. We love the emails that we get from all of you, and you can still email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. From here on out, I mean, we'd like to hear more about impeachment, and maybe we'll tweet about it or something. This will be our last episode on the show, but obviously you can continue to hear Richard and Sonia talking about Succession and email about that. So anyway, we got an email from Mason, who said, "I was so thrilled when you announced you were going to do AECS impeachment because I worked on that show. From May until late August, when shooting wrapped, I worked as a COVID health monitor on impeachment, my first job in the biz. I was essentially a production assistant focused solely on making sure the crew was masked up." So that's a new job on a film set. And so it's a longish email, but he talked about noticing when Edie Falco spoke to you, Richard, about how isolating the COVID protocols were and how challenging that was from his perspective, too. He also noted the production literally lasted over a year, beginning in August of 2020 and wrapping in August of 2021. I had not realized how long that was, which is really, that's really intense and makes me more impressed by what they pulled off.
Well, yeah, one of the things that Sarah Paulson said when I talked to her was that normally she has a lot of incubation time from when she wraps to when something airs, so she can kind of process what she just did, and then she gets audience reaction. But I think for her, it was really only a couple weeks, if even that.
Wow. Yeah, it was really kind of heartbreaking how she talked about how she hadn't, like, had a chance to, like, process the show before the review started coming out, which made me, you know, usually I'm not too sympathetic when actors complain about critics, but I really felt for her when she said that.
Yeah.
So then he talked about how they shot, he said, we shot the grand jury scenes for 5 or 6 days straight. A huge set was built on stage right next to the executive residence set at the Fox lot in Century City, and hardly anyone could fit in there besides the performers and the three cameras. There was one instance where they performed all 7 pages of script for Linda Tripp's testimony, and there was huge applause afterward. And he says that was also the day that the COVID team neglected to put sandbags on a tent, and it blew across the studio lot, smashing into the windshield of Sarah Paulson's car. Yikes, she does not deserve that. No one deserves that, but definitely not Sarah Paulson. And then two more things. The scene where Monica describes the most explicit sexual acts to Judge Immergut was shot on Beanie's birthday. Everyone appreciated the irony. And that the Russian accordion player scene was the last scene for both Edie and Clive, which is why he looks so happy.
That is an amazing trivia note.
I know. I mean, you know, you only get those Russian accordion players for one day, so you got to make the most of that that time on set. Oh, and he's just one more thing, that the real Monica, who we'll hear from later, came to the set the day they shot the Paula Jones Hustler cover shoot, which is fascinating. Like, that is not the day that I would have thought of Monica being on the set, but I guess schedules being what they are. So yeah, thank you, Mason, for all those details from the set.
And for doing that work.
Yes,
so we
seriously.
Can have the show, you know.
Like, really essential, essential work. And then one more email from Tara, which is shorter and funny. When the president was reviewing the list of Congress people who may vote for impeachment, this is on last week's episode, the list was in the Calibri font, which wasn't initially designed until 2002. So we got you, impeachment. That's some historical inaccuracy right there.
Well, you know, that goes in tandem because it comes up again in this episode. I mentioned this, I think, when in the episode with where it was kind of focused on Hillary in Martha's Vineyard. And that kitchen was not period appropriate. We have another not period appropriate kitchen, and now we have a not period appropriate font. So I think this whole show is a wash because of those. Forget it. Toss it out.
But they put so much work into the period appropriate Weight Watchers soup can with the right logo. So,
and a Nilla wafers thing, too. This week.
Okay, so Julie, you have been covering the show right along with us on VF.com. You've been talking to Allison Tripp. You've been, you know, doing a ton of historical research. How's it been for you? What's your, kind of your overall take on the series been and all the learning that you've done?
I have just been so fascinated by just the idea, the thought experiment of reexamining the storyline through all these female perspectives. And I'm going to miss Sarah Paulson's Linda Tripp. I never thought I would think that or say that. but it's been fascinating. And it was nice. I got to speak to Allison Tripp early on after she had seen the first episode of the season. And I got to speak to her after the 9th. And she hadn't been consulted by the series at all. She was very cautious about the series and how it would depict her mother, who she lost not too long ago. Considering that Monica was a producer, she's kind of always been in this defensive stance given what her mother went through. But it was just interesting to be riding along that journey with her. And at the end of the day, she's so appreciative to the entire show and Sarah Burgess in particular, who felt such sympathy, and Sarah Paulson clearly, who felt such sympathy towards Linda for this public resurrection, I guess, of her mother's image. So it's been interesting to go through it through that perspective. But I've also just enjoyed the campier storylines, like the Brett Kavanaugh, who got another feature scene.
They never miss an opportunity to say Kavanaugh, just to remind you who's in there on the star team.
Right. No, but it's just such an interesting cocktail of elements between that sympathizing with Linda Tripp, empathizing with her. And then, you know, you have the Kavanaugh, you have the Linda Tripp, Susan cubicle mate comedic storyline, which I love. And I'm going to miss.
I love that we saw her again this week.
Right.
We'll get to that.
I know Allison said that was one of her favorite storylines too. so that was pretty funny to me. But I'm curious to hear what you guys think of the finale.
Yeah. I mean, we'll get into kind of the beat by beat of it. I'm interested in where it ended. Like, I think I said last week, I was hoping it would maybe jump ahead in the future so we could kind of check in on some of these people. And it ends on a much more melancholy and uncertain note. And I talked to Monica about this in our interview about why that felt like an appropriate place to leave it. And it did feel like the right way to end this story, but it doesn't feel like it's over, which is of course true because many of these people are all still alive and living their lives. But it was an interesting way to conclude it. I wonder what you thought, Richard.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that this episode did, you know, in terms of the artistry, two different sequences that were, you know, maybe obvious but interesting kind of echoes of each other. We have, you know, Paula doing her photo shoot and Hillary being shot by, I believe, Annie Leibovitz.
Definitely an Annie Leibovitz type.
Yeah. And then at the end with the kind of like the interview with George Magazine, May It Rest, and then Monica at the book signing, like these two, like, here is how some of these people landed, and then here are some, you know, here's where other people did. And I thought that that was appropriately somber and thoughtful, even if, yeah, it did end with a bit more of a sort of, I guess, abruptly in a way, after all of that, than I thought it would. But the more I kind of sat with that ending, the more I think it worked, because how else, you know, if you'd gone into the future, I don't know. I think you would have lost that real sense of immediacy that this show has had the whole season.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that like it is so much of the period that it's in. And like the future for some of these people is like less, you know, for, I think Monica's story is pretty inspiring in terms of how she's come past it. I think for Paula Jones, it's pretty different. And I don't know if you could like pick out some of them from this and celebrate them and then, you know, kind of mourn for others. So it makes sense to leave them at the point where they were.
We weren't going to have all the actors dancing to We Are Family at the end, which I had sort of hoped for.
A full Mamma Mia
just
finale.
To cleanse our hearts and minds.
I will say that the Hillary Clinton shoot was, in fact, Annie Leibovitz. It was the December 1998 cover of Vogue with the cover line, "The Extraordinary Hillary Clinton," which tells you a lot about where she was at this point post-impeachment. But I guess we'll get there.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, "Oh, my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?"
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Anything you want to say broadly about the finale, Julie, before we get into the beat by beat of the episode?
Well, just what Richard was saying, there was so much momentum, I feel like, in the last two episodes. I could have gladly gone another episode or two to kind of see. I was especially interested in Linda's, you know, that bit of regret she clearly has. And there is just so much lost emotion, I felt like, between the Monica and the Linda character. I almost wanted some sort of like fantasy fiction add-on where they are able to meet up. But
yeah,
no, it really kind of delivered, I thought, on all the notes I had wanted. And then some. I did not expect there to be this like cut between that Hillary Clinton photo shoot and the Paula Jones photo shoot. That was a real surprise.
Yeah.
But
I also really wanted to see Linda's Christmas tree or Christmas store, obviously,
right.
In Virginia. But you can look up lots of photos of it if you want to scratch that itch.
Allison Tripp also, by the way, said that her stepfather, Linda's surviving husband, comes over to watch the episode each week with the family, in case anyone was curious.
Wow.
I know. And it was very sweet. Allison talked about how her kids miss their grandmother so much. even though they aren't really of age for, like, the Star Report's salacious details. She let them watch. I guess they learned about her mother and the impeachment scandal through school, and it was kind of sad. They would come back afterwards and say, like, is Omi a bad person? Allison was just so grateful to have this series to show them that, you know, her mother
wasn't this really sweet
villainized character that at least she was during her lifetime.
Okay, so let's get into the episode, and I've got it kind of broken down by character, but I think it might be helpful to start with the Star Report part and then the rest of it, which is kind of the denouement of the story. So the episode starts with Monica, and she's kind of hiding out in New York, wearing hats and sunglasses and sneaking around, and goes to meet up with her mom, played by Mira Sorvino, who you also spoke to, Julie, and we should talk about. And she's kind of selling her mom on the notion of doing this book with Andrew Morton. She did do the book. It came out in March of 1999, so after the impeachment process had finished, and kind of after the Star Report had come out. And as they all emphasize throughout the episode, he's who wrote the book with Princess Diana. I have not read the book. The reviews of it were kind of harsh. It's not something that's been, you know, especially held up in the memory. But when you guys were watching this with Monica, were you like, no, don't do it. Just, like, go to school in London, as she will do later in life, and get away from all of this. How'd you feel about where we met Monica here?
Well, something we talked about earlier in this season was the class differences at work. You know, Monica is from this wealthy Brentwood, right? Family. Paula Jones is definitely not. And we both see them doing things because they need the money, you know? And I think mm-hmm. that's one thing in terms of Monica's side of things, where she's paying all these lawyers, these, you know, powerful, expensive lawyers, all this money, and she really needs it. And she gets a huge payday for the book. I think they say $500,000 in this episode. You know, one hopes that she was able to use some of that money to, like, go start her new life. I know she did some other things in the immediate years after this show ends that also probably went toward that. But, like, you know, it's another factor in all of this that I guess I hadn't really considered beyond a couple conversations between Paula and her, you know, then husband, which is the financial thing. I mean, this was, you know, ruinous. Linda's talking about not having a career. Monica certainly doesn't have a career. Paula's in the wind. And so I think it's important that this episode dealt with, like, how these people started to rebuild or reshape their lives. And money, unfortunately, of course, was going to have to be a big part of that.
Well put. I was struck by Monica's savvy in that moment, just knowing how young she is, that she was able to negotiate, you know, Andrew Morton authoring that book. And I did read the book, and it is an interesting pairing of author and subject, because it does sort of cast her in, it's a little bit more of, like, the fairy tale version of the story, which maybe you needed as a counterpoint to the salaciousness of the Star Report. But no, Richard, that's such a good point.
I did read an excerpt of it. I think it's the first chapter, which is almost beat for beat the opening of this series, where it's Monica at the gym, and then she gets a page from Linda, and then she goes to meet her at the mall, and she reads a magazine. And so you do, I think the DNA of this show is a lot in there of being kind of sympathetic to Monica's point of view, although obviously the show kind of expands beyond that. Okay, so we go back to the Star team, I think for the last time. I think this is the last we see Mike Emick and Jackie Bennett and good old Brett Kavanaugh. They're kind of just thrilled to be about to publish the report. As we saw in the previous episode, they're kind of rushing to get it out. I guess it's just after Labor Day comes out. They sent it to Congress on September 10th. And they bring it to the steps of the Hill, and no one knows it's coming. Clinton doesn't know it's coming. Kind of in real life, the Hill, the Congress decided not to let Clinton get a look at it before they published it on the internet, which was 2 days later after the Star team delivered it. And you see this media chaos going around where they tip off Lisa Myers, who we'll talk about more later, and then someone tips off Drudge, and then the White House knows it's coming, and Monica's watching it on TV. And Coulter finds out about it. We're kind of back to the media spectacle, which we've had in previous episodes, which is, as far as I can tell, is pretty much what happened in real life. And for me, it kind of highlighted the publicity-seeking aspect of the Star team, even though they kept claiming they were doing things, like, by the law, like, they were so thrilled by all this chaos that they caused, which I think is a smart way to handle that.
I really liked that we had repeated moments in this whole, you know, Star Report sequence where characters were like, what were they thinking? This is totally off base. Like, obviously these things happened, but you know, and like even Coulter, who's kind of thrilled by the details, and but because she assumes this is like going to be Clinton's undoing, of course it wasn't. Even Coulter is like, well, this is like a distraction. Like they don't really talk about like what the crimes he committed, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that it was interesting to see like that in amid all that sort of flurry of excitement, I suppose, about all this, that people sort of pretty almost near immediately saw that this was going, that the salacious details were going to be distracting from what they hoped would be the thing that would, you know, really nail him to the wall.
Yeah.
There's such a hot mess quotient that I didn't anticipate in all of this going on. I also appreciated, I guess this is a little bit further, but there are like 10 different reactions because of course this is the first time that a story like this is breaking over the internet, where these characters are like, what, the internet? Like, Bill Clinton doesn't understand that this is going to go online immediately. It is such a terrifying TikTok for all the characters involved.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, right after this, we get kind of this cavalcade of, it's like the Tonight reprise in West Side Story, where you see every character back like preparing to be part of the action. Linda Skeeble-Clamate is reading it, Judith Leitza, Susan Carpenter McMillan's reading it, Drudge, like a bunch of anonymous kids in a computer library somewhere, Chelsea at Stanford, Bob Schieffer's reading it live on the air. You've got all these like elbow-to-elbow TV cameras. George Conway, I guess this is maybe the beginning of George Conway getting off of the Republican media machine, is like, nobody's going to focus on the actual crimes in this. It's a spectacle.
We've talked about how this show is kind of partly about like being a precursor to everything that we are living in now, you know, with the internet and a certain kind of expectation from politicians or lack of expectation from politicians. So I really like the kind of early internet humor. Mira Sorvino in particular, she's so good on this on the show, and her asking Monica, has it arrived yet? While this thing is trying to load, as if it's like a letter. And then on the phone with her ex-husband being like, well, can't you ask one of the residents to help you? So ask one of the young people at the hospital or whatever to help you with this. It just felt like, oh God, we were so young once.
And there's that sad moment later where you see Monica's dad again. He's like, I haven't read it. And like,
yeah,
you can't tell if that's true in the way that scene is presented. Like, I hope he didn't, but I felt really bad for both of them in that scene.
No, I was just gonna say I whether or not he had read it, like probably the certain details of it were inescapable, no matter what.
Yes.
I mean, yes,
yeah.
People were far less online. But
I never read the Star Report, but I know a bunch of this stuff. I was 13.
Right. I only went back and read part of it after seeing the first couple of episodes, and it really is just jarring, the kinds of details that make it in there.
So the Star Report comes out, and then we see its impact on a variety of people, but maybe let's start with the Clintons kind of while we're on them. Sidney Blumenthal shows up again. He says that they'll argue that it's too personal and way out of proportion, which I think is pretty much what the argument was. Hillary very pointedly says that she hasn't read it, but Chelsea has. And the impeachment vote is going forward in the meantime, and they're really trying to get the moderates on board. And his advisors tell him that, like, Hillary can make the calls to these advisors because she's super popular. And they too are stunned by how popular she is, to the point that we see she gets a call from Charlie Rangel, who says there's an open Senate seat in New York and you are our first choice. We don't see her answer that. You kind of see the smile on her face. And this is kind of the sequel, right? Like, that's the Hillary's ascendance, which, you know, ends in a way that we all know. But that's the second part of this chapter. While Bill is kind of mired in this self-pity, being like, they're just attacking me. They were always going to do this. Juanita Broderick's another lie. And she's talking him out of it, but already planning her escape route, which I kind of can't help but be proud of her at this point in the series, despite how we know it ends. So then the last time we see Bill on this show is after the impeachment vote. He's impeached in the House. He's acquitted by the Senate, as we know. So he stays in office, and he tells this kind of long joke about a guy hanging from a cliff and asking God why him. And God looks down at him and says, I just don't like you. Do you think that's the true way for Bill Clinton to think of himself and the chances he's been given in life?
That is such self-pitying bullshit. And I appreciate that the crowd in the room, one of whom is Joseph Mazzello, I believe.
Yes. Yep.
It's a very, like, a moment freighted with a lot of, like, concern and, you know, sadness and worry, whatever. but like they don't really react because it's like, oh, come on, dude. Like you're not Job. Like you're not some poor benighted, you know, weary figure. Like you did all this stuff, you know, like the, you brought this on yourself, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a nice little, I was curious how they were going to leave Bill on this show. And I think this was a good button to be, to kind of indicate subtly, I guess, sort of toward the show's kind of overall estimation of how he viewed himself and his sort of like, oh, well, I'm just, you know, I'm a victim here, you know, because clearly that's not true.
Yeah.
Right. I enjoyed this ending on the sort of marital power reversal between the two of them. I was really happy to see Hillary get this moment in the sun, especially considering what she went through and how her poll numbers were continually, I guess, just damaged because of what Bill was doing. But what she was, you know what, let's scratch that whole thing. But I was just glad to see Hillary get this moment in the sun between the Vogue cover and the call about Senate.
Yeah, I definitely forgot that Vogue cover ever happened. So that was like a fascinating thing to revisit. Love that velvet dress. So before we close out with our main characters, we revisit a couple of more minor figures. And we have one return from Drudge and Coulter, which, as much as we may dislike them in real life, I admit I was happy to see them again. And I looked for evidence that Matt Drudge's Fox News set really looked like that. Like
an old noir film.
Well, he said, I told them Dragnet meets Star Trek, which is so funny. But I did find, so the line that Coulter has talking about Paula Jones and her penthouse spread, she used to have dignity and tremendous courage. Turns out she's just the trailer park trash they said she was. That's an exact quote from an Ann Coulter column from that time. She might have said it on TV too, but you know, that tracks with what we would expect from her. And the way that it leaves them with kind of dueling perspectives on if this is the beginning of a conservative movement or not, I think is really interesting, where, you know, Coulter is pretty pessimistic about what's going to happen next. We're going to run our stupidest Bush for president. And Drudge kind of thinks it's the dawn of a new conservative era. And I think he was right and she wasn't. And they both rode that wave pretty effectively. How do you guys feel about where we're leaving them here?
Yeah, there's an interesting kind of prophecy in that. I think also I'm thinking about when Clinton says to one of his staffers, like, have you met the Republican leadership? You know, because she's like, oh, no, the reasonable ones won't do anything, you know. And I think that there's a lot of grim foreshadowing of what is about to happen in just a few short years and then continue to happen for the next 20 years. You know, you listen to Coulter say that and you're like, oh, boy, I wish that were true. And unfortunately, Drudge is seeing the further writing on the wall and is clearly right. And I think a lot of that has to do with Drudge being one of the people who, early on saw the power of the internet, and that, you know, even a president with a clear voting, you know, a mandate from the voters, can be lowed or almost, you know, taken out by stuff that is partly, you know, online.
Yeah.
I just have a more superficial read of it, which I'm going to miss Kobe's Ann Coulter. Just she was having so much fun, which I believe she talked to you guys about. But that read of the character is just with the wine glass in hand and that perfect wig. I'm going to miss that.
Yeah.
I like that she and Lucienne were the ones who were drinking in the middle of the day while absorbing this report. Lucienne with her, I guess it was a martini, and then
looked like
a,
yeah.
Coulter, well, obviously, yeah, with her dry white wine.
Yeah, well, we'll get to Lucienne because she says, like, well, you can't say we didn't have fun. And you do think that Lucienne and Coulter might have enjoyed this process more than anybody.
Well, they didn't really have a stake in it, you know, really. They just could kind of set fires and then watch them burn.
They got to make some money and get famous, so, and then walk away from the whole thing. So let's check in with Paula before I think we get to Juanita Broderick, who's been a more minor player in it. But Paula's penthouse shoot happens. We kind of see her back at home in Arkansas with her mom and her son and struggling. The psychic friends hotline call that she does is really heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, but also kind of hilarious to get another glimpse at Annalee Ashford playing a bad actress, because we've seen Paula like reading lines with her husband before, and now she's reading off of this script. But it also sets up really effectively why she gets this letter from Penthouse and doesn't turn it down because she really needs the money. I did look up that Penthouse had done two stories on her previously, including publishing nude photos of her taken by her 31-year-old boyfriend when she was 19, and she tried to sue to keep that from happening and lost. So this was the third time she'd been in Penthouse, and it was the first time with her consent, which is a really sad button on her story, I think. And then so you guys mentioned earlier that you see her shoot kind of cross-cut with Hillary Clinton's Annie Leibovitz shoot. And that's more or less where we leave Paula. How do you guys feel about it?
I just felt so much anger about the way these women were treated and used and just left behind. So I just was sad the whole episode for her. And I think it's interesting. Paula hasn't really spoken up publicly throughout the run of the series. I'm just curious if she's been watching what her relationship to the story is like now. But I'm just so sad. Again, these are just women whose lives were sort of collateral damage.
Yeah, I you know, I think Emily Ashford is so good in the role, and that scene in particular where she's getting her hair done and is reclaiming a bit of her old self. You know, I don't want to be this DC Beltway conservative figure, you know, who or tool or prop or whatever, who has to keep her hair flat and not look, you know, not look good and you know, whatever. And she has this moment of connection with this hairdresser, a woman on a very male dominated set, you know, who is in an industry like a lot of women on the show are, that is really controlled by men, that is predatory toward women. And she thinks she kind of has a little moment with her. And then, of course, much like Linda in the elevator with the random person who asks her and who Linda tells about the Cobb salad, like, nope, like, can't escape this even here, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfectly believable scenario.
Yeah. And you've got before that the kind of heartbreaking, it's not really betrayal from Susan, because we've known all along that Susan was not operating with Paula's best interest in mind, but Paula really thought she was. And for Susan to kind of call her and just shame her. And, you know, credit to Paula for, you know, sticking up for herself, even though she's making a kind of questionable choice. But, you know, I liked Judith Light. I liked Susan. I wanted to believe the best in her. And then she just kind of kicks Paula to the curb like everybody else.
Trivia note, did you know that Susan was actually at the mall that same day where Monica was there trapped for whatever, being questioned, that terrible manhandled episode? In addition to,
I saw that somewhere.
Right. In addition to Linda being there shopping while Monica was kind of being held by these FBI or government officials, Susan was also shopping for earrings for Paula.
That's so crazy. And then you know why they didn't put it in the show, because it just would have been like, what? That's not real. But there it was. Okay, so we leave Paula, and then kind of a thread throughout this episode is Lisa Myers at NBC News getting this interview with Juanita Broderick, who we've seen a couple times before. She has recanted her affidavit saying that Bill Clinton did not assault her, and then is a footnote in the Star Report. And it's kind of an effort from an aide to Lindsey Graham, who shows up twice in this episode. It's this guy, and then they say Laura Ingraham's dating Lindsey Graham. And so Juanita does this interview with Lisa Myers, and she's promised, as she sits down for it, that will come out before the impeachment process is over. But it doesn't. By the time it airs, impeachment is over. And NBC has said at the time that it wasn't really political. They were trying to fact check it. But I think since then, it's that logic has kind of come into question. And before I let you guys talk about this interview, I will say that the NBC executive who was in charge of it, who kind of gave quotes to the Washington Post about why they held it at the time, was Andrew Lack, whose name you might remember because he was also accused of killing Ronan Farrow's Harvey Weinstein story, and was also close friends with Matt Lauer, and was I don't want to say fired. He left NBC last year after a whole bunch of stuff that happened on his watch. So that's history echoing itself, I guess.
One of the things this show has done so chillingly is be like, oh, these names that you heard recently, they've been around for so long, like between Kavanaugh and Andrew Lack and just Coulter and Ingraham and Drudge, everyone. It's just like nothing is that new, you know. To think about where Juanita Broderick was being sort of thrown into and her sort of questions like, when is this going to run? You know, all this stuff like that. that these industries, the sort of quote unquote safer havens for these women, were also compromised in a serious way. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just think this episode is doing a, you know, we said it doesn't jump forward in time to show us like where people ended up, but it does jump forward in time in terms of the way it's like echoing a lot of recent news. You know, it's like, yes. No, this is not over by any means. It's only going to continue.
Well, Renita Broderick's story is one of the ones that I think got a lot of fresh attention during the 2016 campaign and the Me Too movement and all of those things, kind of looking back at it, because as we see in this presumably apocryphal thing of two people at a bar asking to switch the TV over to the Grammys, she didn't get that much attention because her story really came out after impeachment. And then in 2016 and 2017, a lot of people looked back and thought, why wouldn't we assume that she's credible? So it's something that's kind of haunting. And I don't think the show really resolves it because it's hard to. Also because Juanita Broderick, along with Paula Jones, attended the 2016 debate and as a guest of Donald Trump. So it gets really complicated really fast. But I do think it was important to include here just to see that as part of the story.
Yeah.
Right. And Juanita was not doing interviews throughout the series because she's writing a screenplay about her experiences. Just a trivia note.
I would watch that probably. Did that scene in the bar make you guys think of the Truman Show at the end where they like changed the channel after all the drama of the Truman Show?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. What else is on?
Yeah, basically.
And what is it was the Grammys, right?
The Grammys.
And she's like, oh, we missed it. I don't know what performance she was sad to have missed, but yeah.
Yeah, we'll have to go look up the 1998 Grammys.
And exactly who played at what minute. And then try to pinpoint what time it is at the bar. Yeah.
Well, I will say immediately after that, and we'll get to Linda in a minute, but there's the scene of Linda undergoing plastic surgery, and the surgeons are talking about, they say, Santana and Rob Thomas are coming to the Meriwether Post Pavilion, which is a very 1999 sentence. And I looked it up on Wikipedia. There's a very detailed Wikipedia page for the Supernaturals tour that Santana went on. So that was June 14th, 1999.
I don't believe just that, because you know, that's 22 years ago. There's no way that music I was keenly aware of 22 years ago. I mean, I feel like Rob Thomas was like 5 years ago. Matchbox 20?
Yeah. No, because 1999 was also 5 years ago. We're very young.
Again, not they're getting some historical accuracy things on here.
Okay, I think we can get to Linda now, and her also super complicated resolution of this story. The first time we see her in the episode, she is going to a law office to meet with her lawyer, and the security guys are kind of laughing at her behind her back, which is presumably a pretty common thing for her. This is November 1998, so we're past the Starr report. And she is at risk of being indicted for taping because they claim she has federal immunity from the Star team, but not state. And they mentioned that Monica would be a witness against her. And then she gives kind of another speech about how the forces of the world are against her. She's been locked out of her job. And I wrote down a good bit of what she said. I trusted our institutions to trust a person like me, but instead I've been abandoned to an unceasing nightmare in which somehow everyone agrees that in this whole god-awful national tragedy that I'm the villain. It doesn't make any sense. Julie, as our Linda and Tripp family correspondent, how did that play for you?
I mean, it was just sad. And I felt like it very much kind of linked to the later scene where Linda's talking to her daughter, Allison, about her father and how he was this cheater and kind of a bad man, but people still preferred him. He still kind of won the situation over the family and the females. Mm-hmm. I think it did a really good job of, again, getting into Linda's complicated motivations for perhaps going through with what she did. But I thought it was well put. Another every Linda scene I've been pretty much there for, between Sarah's performance and the writing, I thought was just incredible there.
Yeah.
What I didn't know about the plastic surgery. Was that like
it was a big thing.
Was it?
And Linda went on Larry King afterwards, and Larry asked her point blank, like, you got plastic surgery. And it's kind of heartbreaking to look at the transcript, because Linda explains, like, my kids used to think I was this beautiful person, but then this story happened and they saw their mother being made fun of all over the place, her appearance. And she made it seem in that interview, at least, as though that had been the reason, but Allison spoke a little bit too, just about how much that criticism obviously hurt her, that she would want to kind of soften the edges of her face. But it's just so sad and chilling to see how both she and Paula, you know, kind of took the public's criticism as, I don't know, as real. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Linda's saying, I, you know, very matter-of-factly, like, I didn't realize how ugly I was, you know, in this way. Is it's just like, this is just accepted wisdom, you know?
Exactly.
That's
a direct line from a, she did an interview on, I think it's 2020, it was introduced by Barbara Walters, you can watch the clip, with Nancy Collins, who actually did that George interview, and she said, until all this happened, I didn't know how ugly I was, which is heartbreaking. And that everyone was just so frank about it. They're like, wow, Linda, you dropped 30 pounds. You got this new look, new lease on life. Like, there wasn't any sense of tragedy in her choice there, which, you know, however Linda presented it was how she chose to do it. And maybe she was really happy with it. But the way that the show depicts it, it's hard not to feel bad about it. So we do see Linda reunite with Lucianne one more time. And I would have been sad not to see Lucianne again. And they're at some, I don't know, some party. And like we said before, like, Lucianne's pretty blasé about the whole thing. And, you know, she says that Linda can't get a book. And Linda's like, this was never about a book. And Lucianne's like, okay. And then Lucianne says she'll miss the Clintons when they go. And Linda's kind of horrified by it. And you see how Linda's kind of the, like, moral crusader. And she still thinks that's what she's doing. And Lucianne is just, like, on to the next thing.
Yeah, the sort of... Lucianne being like, oh, there's a woman who needs a drink. Let's get sauced, you know, or whatever she says. And you're like, oh, like, finally Linda has found, like, an ally or refound her, and she's in a safe space. It's a safe space full of monsters, sure, but from my perspective anyway. But, like, it's something. And then just a few minutes later, Lucianne very casually is like, oh, no, you're old news, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And I that's quite a... you know, a stark kind of realization for Linda, and you feel for her because she thought maybe at least this, you know, I don't think that making common cause with Lucianne Goldberg is like a good thing to do, maybe, but I wanted her to at least have one moment of fun and communion with another person, and then it didn't happen.
A safe space full of monsters is an incredible title for a chapter, a book. I don't know what, but
I'm... Well, that's what the book that Katie's writing about Wesleyan.
Perfect. Let's see. So then, go ahead, Julie.
Oh, I was just going to say, as a sad footnote, when Linda finally did write the book, I think it's called Basket Full of Deplorables. She wrote it with a co-author, and then she died during the middle of the book before it was published, and the publisher kind of took control, picked the title of the book, picked the photos, and it's sad that, you know, she didn't want this book, but she finally went ahead with the book, and her daughter just said how outraged her mother would have been by the way the story was framed.
Have you read that book?
I read selections, and it does have a lot of Linda's first person observations at the time, but Allison just was so horrified by the packaging of it. She said her mother would be up in arms.
Oh, that is a shame. So we leave Linda in her lunch meeting for George Magazine talking about JFK Jr., which, of course, like, if I had met someone who had worked for George Magazine, I'd probably also ask if you met JFK Jr. She's had her plastic surgery. She seems pretty proud of it. And she, you know, walks past Monica's book signing and keeps going. And, you know, I think that she's asked in the interview if she'd ever reach out to Monica, and she says that wouldn't be welcome. But that's really the end of Linda. And we've talked about Linda a lot in this episode, so I think we all agree that's a good place to end it. But any final Linda thoughts from this scene or otherwise?
I like that she said, again, that she was clarifying. I think she said that Monica was his victim, not hers. I thought that was just a good through line, but it does just make me so sad for both women. And I just am curious what an episode after this would look like.
Yeah, there's an interesting thing there about, we have a very, there's a commonplace kind of idea these days about, like, well, I have to tell my story and you know, my truth and all that stuff. And you know, that has been used in service of a lot of good things. But I think that what this show, what that scene really brings home is, like, you can't you can't do that for someone else necessarily, you know?
Hmm.
And Linda is right about the power dynamic between Bill and Monica. She's right about a lot of things, but her mistake was in, and maybe she's just justifying after the fact. Maybe those weren't really her reasons, or maybe they kind of were. When I talked to Paulson, I think she kind of had a, you know, there was a sort of a lot at play. It's a mix of those things. Is that like, yeah, you, this, that wasn't yours to declare though. So publicly, you know,
mm-hmm.
And, I don't know that she sees that in the end, but I think Linda can at least cling to the simple truth that she is right about, the kind of, the bad thing that happened and who was at fault for it.
Right. Yeah. And even though she doesn't say there's any regret, I think you see it on Sarah's face. Maybe she doesn't need to say that explicitly.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the more brilliant things about this performance is how the distance between what Linda says and what she feels is really always evident. And we can't know for sure what she really felt versus what she said. But I think the interpretation of what this version of Linda would have really felt is really visible. And I'm kind of constantly fascinated by how Sarah Paulson pulls that off.
And the way that in a couple little short things, like this episode does show you that, like, she was kind. I mean, she's, you know, it's a simple thing, a tiny thing, but she's, like, nice to the waiter during the George Magazine interview. And she kind of perks up when she's like, oh, yeah, it's a classic place to eat. Like, their Cobb salad is famous, you know, like she can be relatable and sort of pleasant, you know, and mm-hmm. She just got sort of sucked into this obsession that. I think didn't reveal a lot of her true character.
No one could have foreseen how this would turn out.
Well, let's close on the show, Monica, before we hear from the real Monica. In this episode, she's mostly kind of hanging out, I believe, at her parents' house in Los Angeles. And we kind of see her reacting to the Star report, seeing this press conference of feminists defending Clinton, which I think we've talked about to varying degrees about how feminists felt like they had to really stand behind him and didn't really rush to her defense in large numbers. And then there's this long scene of her on a very beautiful Los Angeles hike with her friend, which, Julie, you lived in LA for a long time, so you can tell us where that was.
Right,
it's
right.
Really that pretty in real life. They're both wearing amazing 90s hats, very accurate for the period. And what I love about this scene, like, you kind of see her reflecting on hearing the tapes and this version of herself, but you really see her sense of humor about herself, which I think is you can hear in the interview with the real Monica in a little bit. She's funny, and you see her in the grand jury testimony that she's funny. And I think that's a really, even though the episode ends on this uncertain moment for her, I think that hike with a friend really tells you more about how she's going to be okay and get through it. That she's got real friends, that she's got an ability to kind of move past it, and or at least like go on a hike and get away from it for a little while.
Right. I appreciated that they ended her character on an upbeat, optimistic note of strength throughout the episode. They clearly could have, you know, focused in on the darker emotions and understandable reactions to that entire saga. But I appreciated that they, even though she was the victim of this unthinkable scandal, I guess, by the media, treatment by the media, that she was able to be optimistic and, again, so savvy, considering what she went through.
Yeah,
we see her when she's doing her last testifying, and she's like, look, can we just get through this? Like, I have lawyers, I'm paying a lot of money. Yeah. You know, and she there's a hard one savvy, you know. Obviously the final note of Monica is one of a bit of disquiet, you know, but the hiking scene, I think, is so lovely. And I mean, look, they're literally gazing out at the horizon. It's not subtle, but it's effective. I mean, I've never seen Los Angeles that clear, by the way, the sky wise, but they must have, I don't know how the hell they filmed that. But I think that one thing the show doesn't tell you is that Monica, right before this hike, because I read something about this, right before the hike, she and her friend broke onto the set of Blossom and stole those hats.
Oh. I was like, wait, is this a real, yes.
I think Blossom was not running at that in 1999. But
I think I had that straw hat that Monica's wearing, though. That's very familiar looking to me.
I feel like my sister had it for an American Girl doll, but maybe there was like a,
ooh,
like,
yeah,
a human sized version.
Had that.
Yeah.
So we see Monica going back to testify one more time. She's moving on. It's, you know, it's kind of one step forward, two steps back, or two steps forward, one step back, depending on how you look at it. Because right after that hike, she turns on the TV and sees someone being like, can you imagine your son coming home and saying he's going to marry Monica Lewinsky? So it's always there. And she can't help herself from turning the TV on. You know, you want her to not do it. And she does it anyway. It's unavoidable.
Yeah, I thought about that son line. Like, the kind of broader implication of that is like, can you imagine if your son had sex with someone who also has had sex previous to your son? And it's like,
well,
yeah,
it's like,
sure.
Why are you thinking about your son's sex life so much, right. You guys? Just like leave him alone.
It's just so gross. I mean, you know, and obviously entirely, many people said similar things, I'm sure, at that time and since.
Yeah. So we see her packing up the apartment at the Watergate again, because you remember in the very first episode, we see her packing up thinking that she's moving to New York. And it's a nice little full circle symbol of how much her life has been trapped for the previous 2 years. And again, with that kind of dark sense of humor, she finds her letter accepting her into the White House intern program, which I hope she burned. I would not have kept it if I were her. And then I love when we jump ahead to her in New York. And I do remember from the coverage at the time being like, Monica's living in New York now and she's designing handbags. I can't remember where the handbags fit in. And she has the universally acknowledged symbol of moving on with your life. She's carrying this beautiful bouquet of flowers down the street. Like, if you're carrying flowers, you're either like in a good place, you're about to be assassinated. And I'm glad that it's a positive symbol for her. What do you guys think of her apartment?
It's big.
It's beautiful.
She's lived in the Watergate. She's used to large spaces.
Yeah, I mean, I did a little bit of reading about like where Lewinsky went, right, you know, following this, like 2000, 2001. And there was some not great stuff, you know. I mean, she was just trying to get by, you know, much in the same way that Paula Jones was. But I think that what the person, you know, in the bar turning off, changing the channel on the television shows you is that, like, and all the stuff with the apartment and the hike and all the kind of moving on aspect is that, like, that people do slowly forget. I know that Lewinsky herself has written for this magazine and in other places and talked a lot about, like, it didn't end for her anytime soon, you know, and probably never will. But there was at least some, like, the immediacy of it kind of did eventually fade, you know. And I think it's nice to see her in a new place and kind of trying to do something. And then of course the last scene is a little bit less hopeful, but
yeah. So we get to that book signing in the last scene. I assumed that was that was supposed to be the Union Square Barnes and Noble. I don't know if that was as obvious a signifier for everybody, but that just felt right. And in the interview with Monica in a minute, she says that actually happened in London. You know, that's a kind of a simple way to simplify the story there. And it ends on her kind of taking a minute after all this huge crowd of people surrounding her saying, I'll be okay. Not I am okay, but I'll be okay. Which is kind of heartbreaking. Julie, how'd you feel about it?
It was heartbreaking, but again, I appreciated just that she was the victim of this whole series, and they gave her that strength at the end and kind of showed what had been forged through all this public unthinkable trauma. So I just appreciated that little bit of upbeat, even if in the moment she is not okay. Did you talk?
I'll tell you a brief story about that Barnes and Noble Union Square. We can cut this, but the day that my book came out, I was like, everyone's like, you have to go see it in a bookstore, and I was like, oh no. And I was like, you know what? At like 7 p.m., I was like, fine, I'm just going to go do it. I got on the Q train, went to Union Square, walked upstairs to the young adult section. And because my last name begins with an L, the shelves are A through L and then M through Z. So mine was on the bottom shelf in a corner behind a ladder. And I was like, oh, okay.
So you're saying there weren't like crowds of people waiting to meet you at the
There were. I mean, just hundreds of people. They were so excited. But
Monica's last name starts with an L too, so maybe hers was in the same spot.
Well, right. Hopefully not in the young adult section, but yes.
So yeah, we'll hear from Monica, I think, and maybe we'll share our final thoughts after that. So let's listen to my interview with Monica Lewinsky.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration. A kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta, name your dinner emergency, we're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
So, Monica, thank you for joining us on this show. It's been, you know, we've been watching all 10 episodes of Impeachment. We've been talking about it in detail. We've been really excited to hear from you. And it's so exciting to talk to you now that the whole series has aired, because I just want to know how you feel now it's all out there. The season is done. How does it feel?
I'm relieved. Really, it is. It has been an extraordinary experience to sort of to wear both hats of being a producer and a subject. And so I think that, and my first time doing both of those in that way has meant that I've learned a lot on the job. But I really, you know, as a producer, I'm very proud of the show. And I think everybody, everyone involved just worked really hard, especially during COVID, but I think really poured themselves into this idea of trying to bring forth, this story that everybody thinks they know. And they know details of in a more nuanced way with more humanity. You know, it was fascinating. I don't know if I can quote him, so I won't say who it was, but someone last night made such an interesting point about how the first six episodes really reshape episodes 7 through 10, which 7 through 10 is sort of, you know, the part where you come in where the rest of the world came into this story. And so I'm really fascinated by this idea of what it means to provide all of that context and nuance, which I hope is what happens. So for people, I don't know what your experience has been.
Oh, man. I mean, it's really the same thing. And it's been a lot of interesting things of like what I thought I knew, what I did know, what I never knew. I think when you talk to people of different generations and different ages, you know, when we've had previous guests on the show, we asked them what they remember from the time, and everyone has a lot of really wide variety of answers. Even people who are pretty informed now, like the way that that story trickled into people was really different. And I'm sure you've encountered that plenty of times talking to people about it too, what people think they know and what they actually do know.
Right. Well, I also think, you know, one of the things, and we see this reverberating today too, is that this whole problematic but very human story was just really, I think the top note to it was political ideology. So that's so much, you know, that's a lot of what I hear from people too, of just, you know, I actually work with somebody who very generously said to me a couple of years ago, he said, you know, I feel terribly because I saw you and your family, like, I just never thought about it because I'm such a staunch Democrat. I just saw it through that lens. And, you know, I mean, that's one of the things, one of the reasons that one works on something like this is that you hope it's sort of by looking and combing through the past, you know, with a magnifying glass in some ways that we learn something to bring forward.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about that a lot, about how it really scrambles your partisan alliances watching the show. Like, I think it really encourages you, even if you, like that guy you spoke to, are a staunch Democrat, you think, who was in the wrong here, who was making bad decisions, and who was maybe making or had the righteous cause but went about it in the wrong way. It's not easy to have partisan lines in the way this show tells the story, which I really appreciate.
Oh, good. Good.
So you mentioned last night you were at a screening and a Q&A with all the women of impeachment, basically. And I'm not sure how much you've been in touch. And with COVID, I know you probably haven't gotten together much. So what was that experience like of capping the series with everybody back together?
You know, it was such a I think magical is actually the word that kind of comes up for me. And it was, so I got to be the moderator, which I enjoy asking the questions instead of answering a lot more.
Me too.
Although I somehow managed to stress myself out and over prepare in the exact same way. It was a little annoying, but there we are. So it was great. So I moderated a panel with Sarah Paulson, Beanie Feldstein, Annalee Ashford, and Sarah Burgess, who's the writer, in case people don't know. And Annalee was Paula, Beanie played me, Sarah was Linda. And it was, it was so lovely to all be together and to sort of have this moment of discussing the show and the process and the experiences in a warm environment like that, just kind of loose. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd spent time with Beanie, but Sarah Paulson, Beanie and I hung out together in July. There was they did like a screening of episode one, in July. And so, it was, you know, it's a very surreal experience. I think we all sort of toggle back and forth, but we have this shared landscape now of experience, you know, and certainly Beanie understands my lived experiences in a very unique way.
What a funny experience to have having, you know, your story being understood by people and people kind of choosing the version of you to know, and then having a relationship with Beanie and her diving into it from your perspective. I wonder if that reframes the way you think of it as just kind of having another you out there.
One me is enough, right? The two versions of me that were in 98, you know, that was like, wow, okay. But I think most people who know me well would be like, I'm already enough, too much. a little Monica in your life. But one of the things, and we talked about this, I won't keep saying, we talked about this last night, but I think one thing that was really interesting, and I was curious to hear from Beanie, because the thing that I've heard a lot from people is how they've been surprised, even though they obviously didn't have the same experiences that I had, that they've been surprised to find themselves in Monica's experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that has so much to do with how Beanie sort of created this space for the quote unquote public or the audience in a way of really finding the humanity in my story and by focusing on those things, I think really trying to bring the emotional truth with those aspects. Like everyone has had heartbreak. Most people have been betrayed in some way or some point. Beanie spoke really eloquently last night about, and so true, you know, what your early 20s are like when you first get out, you know, there's this very strange pod of time, you know, in your early 20s where there's sort of this age you're looking to get to and you think, now I'm going to be an adult. And once I'm an adult, I'm into this and I'm into that and I'm the other. And then, you know, you come into the world, you have no idea about consequences. You have no idea, you know, about I think, so many different things, right? That sort of fabric of life that we get with age. And, but at the same time, you know, in hindsight, you realize just how fucking young you are and how little you know. And, you know, we all experience. So I think that when you're just trying to figure out who you are in the world, and so much of that starts to come from reflections of what you see and hear from other people in a way that's different from how we're shaped by our family.
Yeah. You've talked about how you didn't want to let yourself off the hook as a producer, and you encouraged the writers to include moments that maybe, you know, weren't as flattering to you. And you talked about the thong moment, but the one that really stuck with me is in the Revlon job process, and there comes in an offer to work at the UN, and Beanie as you is like, I don't want to work at the UN. And it's this very kind of childish moment.
Yes.
I think she gets called out on the show for like being kind of spoiled about it. And right. I wonder about you signing off on that moment and including it and why it felt worth doing.
You know, I think just first to be really clear, there was no, I didn't have a sort of sign off there. I didn't have approval in that way. So I think that there was meaningful dialogue, but, you know, there were things in the show and things in my past that I wish, you know, hadn't been there, or different things. But if I liked everything that was in the show, then I don't think everybody did their job, you know? Sure. So, but it was, you know, I think that it was an important moment because it sort of reflected my age in some ways too, the immaturity and the sense of, I think that, it was less about I mean, some people could look at it and say it was a moment of entitlement, which they're fair to look at it that way. I think how I perceive it more, knowing myself, having been there, I think that in it was very much just about not understanding how the world really works, you know, mm-hmm. in that way. I mean, right. Like, remember, this was all, you know, I had my internship and then my job in legislative affairs. So it was the first time I was hired post-college, you know, I had part-time mm-hmm. jobs. This was my first full-time job. I think just that idea. And then when I was at the Pentagon, I was, this being like way too detailed of a thing, but anybody who knows like how the government system works, it's like a GS rating and your GS rating determines your pay. Mm. And so I was a GS-9, but most of the people who at the Pentagon who had the same job I did for other principals were usually like a GS-13. So they're okay. people who had been in the system for a very long time. So my whole sense of the work and work ethic like that way was warped, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a very long answer. Sorry.
Well, no, but I think that does a really good, exactly what you said of just being like not seeing all the different wheels in motion and not realizing that this is going to become public knowledge, which is the theme of the whole show.
Yeah, exactly. And also I didn't like working at the Pentagon. That's, you know, nothing against the people who were there. I was young. I couldn't appreciate a lot of things. I mean, I often joke that it was like, I was like Private Benjamin there. You know, I went shopping at Banana Republic to go to Bosnia for the first time. I was like, what do I wear to meet the troops in Bosnia? You know, so it's like, I better go to Banana Republic. And, you know, unlike every other person in DC, I didn't own khaki pants. So I had to get khaki pants because that's what you wear to meet the troops. And, you know, so I think that it was just where the White House and Ryan had a sense of this instinctively in how he was toning the show. You know, there's all of this color that's, you know, both at the White House and from my time at the White House. And there is a sort of, you know, fluorescent light blandness that comes through at the Pentagon.
Yeah, no, that is incredible. Mm-hmm. I want to ask about the final episode and where it leaves you. And because I was really kind of hoping for a real jump in the future, like your TED Talk or something mm-hmm. like that, kind of catch up with you now. And it leaves the Monica of the show at this real moment of moving forward. It's Beanie Feldstein saying, I will be okay. And you're not sure that she will.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
That
no.
seems very true to the way that you speak about that time in your life. And I just, does that feel true? Does that feel like the way to end the story, that it's not necessarily a guaranteed happy ending, that there's a lot of work to do left?
Yeah, I really, really hope nobody finishes the episode and thinks that this was a happy ending. So because you're 100% right that there is an ambiguity there that's sitting there or a subtlety, but the point around it is, you know, like in a trauma response effort, Monica is trying to tell herself she will be okay. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'm using me in the third person just because it's the script.
I know. I have a
wonderful friend who's in the industry, who's just helped me a lot throughout this process and giving me guidance and different things. And he's always he's like always reminding me it's Monica in quotations, you know, there's you and then there's the character Monica in quotations.
Well, that's what she says in this episode too. She's like, I got to go out and be Monica. So yeah. It's an extra layer of
right.
Of
and it's a, you know, it's such a, I think it's so hard for people to understand. It would be hard for me to understand. We know, fame, celebrity, notoriety, whatever those things are, most of the time we see them because someone has sought them in some way. And so they've just kind of prepared and to have been someone who, you know, aside from like maybe wishing I could be a better performer in musical theater, I didn't want to be famous. I didn't want to be well known. So it was such a steep climb, you know, to just be thrust onto the world stage at such a young age and then become a public person and to come to understand their expectations of you, you're a commodity.
Is that how you remember that book signing in particular? Does that one?
So the thing is, like a lot of the things in the show, there are, you know, truncated timelines and location. So the actual location was in London. My first book signing was in London. And it was, I had a freak out because for over a year, I had run. Every time there were cameras in my face and people were flashing, I ran, I hit, you know, the instinct was people were taking something from me. And here I was, I had voluntarily been sitting there. I had made this I made this decision to do that. And it was terrifying. It was just really overwhelming is probably a better word.
Yeah. I mean, so your HBO Max documentary, 15 Minutes of Shame, is about basically exactly what the title says, like people now enduring what you did for their 15 minutes of being shamed online. And it's a lot about what you're talking about not signing up for it. And it debuted last month as the series has been airing. So what's it felt like having those both out there in the world at the same time? Is it like the past and the present colliding?
Yes.
Does it feel like they speak to each other?
It's yes, they very much so. I mean, in some ways, you know, it's sort of like a soft coda. The doc is kind of a soft coda in some ways that it's been both fantastic, I think, because there ended up being this interesting crossover and overlap. On me personally, it's been challenging because I don't like doing media. It takes a lot for me to show up to do these kinds of things. So to have two projects coming out, was a little overwhelming, but I, you know, was really lucky that all of the people with whom I spoke about both projects, you know, came to the table with just an interest in the projects or an interest in me that wasn't gotcha journalism like I had before. So I'm very grateful for that. But I think that there is this, you know, there's this, for me, what was fascinating with 15 Minutes of Shame, not only just to kind of see how this has exploded as a social pandemic, but I was really into the kind of the, we call them history pods in production, but just the kind of the history that threaded through of stepping back and looking at, you know, where did we go? Shaming's been around since the beginning of time and throwing stones and what it meant when it was a social tool. To then becoming commoditized and to sort of see where my story and technology all braided together and what those moments meant was really fascinating to me.
I think it's so interesting that it's happening. Your documentary and the show are coming at this moment where we're looking back at stories of the past and rethinking them with your story, the Britney Spears documentaries. Like there's a lot of it happening for a lot of women, not a coincidence that it's mostly women. And yet, I think as your documentary shows, when a new person shows up on social media, everyone just jumps on it again to judge them. Like, we can't resist that urge to see people one-dimensionally. Why are we so bad at this still? And are we getting better at it, at least, you think?
You know, what I have liked to have seen more progress in the last, you know, 5-6 years, fuck yes, you know. I think the fact that we have certainly seen throughout history, there have been many times where there have been problems and issues and they've been buried underneath and people don't talk about them. So the fact that they're, you know, we have an incredible outlet like HBO Max, who's paying to have a documentary to talk about these issues and we are looking at them is a positive sign. You know, human nature is complicated. And I think another place where these two things dovetail in terms of American Crime Story and 15 Minutes of Shame is around the American Crime Story, you know, the anthology series is very much about, I was so fascinated to learn this. It's not that it's a crime that happened in America. It's a crime that was, you know, abetted by Americans.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and by the audience is implicated in what happens. And I think that's very much, you know, yes, we, you know, technology and the platforms need to change. You know, yes, the laws need to change. But we, human nature, human behaviors, there are things we can do right now to start to change that too. And I hope that, you know, people will see from watching 15 Minutes of Shame to understand, you know, stories of people or names that you knew and to see what happened behind the scenes and behind the curtain there, to have a real experience of that tsunami of shame coming at you. I hope it encourages people to rethink their behavior just a little.
Have you watched the Britney Spears documentaries or the Paris Hilton ones or any of the other ones kind of in this, what I think of as this, not a genre, but like encouragements to rethink the past? Do those resonate with you?
So, you know, I have not, I haven't because there are, I think that there's like, I've of course been very aware of all the media around them and had a lot of conversations around them and know what happens in different ways. But there's, I think because they came out like while we were working on the show, I don't know if this is going to sound weird to people. I just felt in some ways, it was challenging for me to work on the show, challenging to go into the past. And so I just felt like I needed to be protective of the time, the emotional, not my time, but my emotional space. And
yeah.
Does that make any sense? Like,
oh yeah. Well, that's like been the work, right? For, you know, for a while of learning to protect your emotional space.
Yes, exactly. So, I think that there were so many times that I got triggered, you know, from things that nobody ever would have imagined I would have gotten triggered from, that I just thought, well, I better wait to do that. I better wait to read that or watch that. And, given my lived experiences, I felt like I can speak in, you know, in an informed way on what that means. And I think it is very important that we are having those conversations, and that people are listening and that they're understanding that when somebody becomes, whether it's through shame or something else, they become a public commodity, that and not in a way that's consensual, not by their choice. Mm-hmm. That there's a price that person pays, and when they're in the public eye, what's really important to understand about that too is that we as a collective, particularly, you know, the gender or the sex or the, you know, all of those aspects, those people all pay collectively as well. Young women mm-hmm. paid a price of seeing what happened to Brittany, seeing Paris, seeing what happened to me, you know, whether I made a mistake and they didn't, it sends a message to other people. And I think that's something that we have to be mindful of too, that there is collateral damage with these kinds of things that happen publicly.
That links up with a recurring thing on the show I wanted to ask you about, which is about the way it treats 90s diet culture and body culture, which it's not an explicit theme of the show, I don't think, but it's just there. It's kind of ever present, especially in the show version of Monica and Linda. And looking back at that, you know, you were watching these episodes. Do you look back at now and think about how crazy that was? Does it feel like a really important way to frame that story? Because it hit me hard seeing it depicted that way.
Yeah. I think it's like my brain goes in two places. So one, I think you're younger. You're definitely, I know you're younger than me, but you're a different generation. So I'm embarrassed to tell you, I'm still the same way about, like, I hope nobody ever surreptitiously records me again or listens into my conversations, but that's probably, I probably still talk about those kinds of things a lot. But I also, for me, my inroad into it was really, I think it was actually because in the first episode that happens. And I think it was a very rich moment for me with the producers and Sarah Burgess, the writer, because I think I was experiencing that lunch scene between Linda and Monica as all I had in my head was the SNL skits. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. So all I could see, and I was like, are you mocking us? You know, and I couldn't understand, you know, what it meant that it was not being written that way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that it was a very interesting, you know, this is not answering your question, but I just think it was an interesting moment in production of understanding, of them understanding what my ground zero was, like what I was, know, so it's that I didn't have an experience of seeing somebody portray me, except for in mocking skits. So, but it was, I think it was very evocative of the times though, too. I think, you know, if the equivalent of it today is the conversations would be like, well, I, you know, can't have lunch now because my intermittent fasting isn't over for an hour, or, well, this, I found this great keto friendly bloop-de-bloop-de-bloop, right? So we still do it. I think it's just maybe not, the branding is different. The branding is around the way we eat the program versus like Weight Watchers and the Smart Ones and a, you know, Slim Fast and, ooh,
And I think it just sets up so much the way that women are valued in the world of the political world that's being set up in this show, and like how you are taught to value yourself. And it's so much of the scenery of what was going on.
Right. Well, and so also, effective. Too, I think that it speaks very much to, it's an inroad into that conversation of not only as a culture, what we did with people who did not set out to be well-known. You know, Paula, Linda, myself, all had our appearances picked apart, you know, and usually in mocking ways. And I think that's a reflection of, you know, and go broader. I think that Hillary Clinton also had that there was this broader sense of misogyny, you know, that I had always hoped there would sort of be, but it just didn't work, of like, you know, this moment of, I'm sure one could have found a day where Paula Jones, Linda Tripp, myself, Hillary Clinton, like any Kathleen Willey, Juanita Broderick, like all of these women were being, you know, scrutinized for their physicality in some way in the media in one day, you know? Yeah. So it was just, I think that's, you know, it is misogyny is bipartisan.
It's amazing how that works. I have to say, I know the 90s fashion on the show can really run the gamut, but there are some really good outfits that Beanie wears that I have like thought about. Like some of it has held up that I was impressed, because there's a lot that we would all prefer to leave behind, but some good stuff.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I was a long proponent of floral dresses and combat boots. So
yeah. And they're back.
I know. It's funny because I'm very close to my Aunt Debbie. And when I was in high school, my mom, I wanted a pair of Doc Martens. My mom was like, that's ridiculous. Those are men's shoes or whatever. But, you know, whatever, like, those are not ladylike, whatever. She, yeah. You know, if she didn't like it, then I shouldn't wear it, kind of a thing. And my aunt, of course, like took me out and bought them for me. And then when I wore them with dresses, it was like, I think my, you know, my family was like, what are you doing? I'm like, this is stylish.
make their heads explode. That's yeah. What you're supposed to do when you're young.
Yeah.
So you go into working on this show kind of not unwillingly, but knowing that if someone's going to tell the story, you want to be part of it. And this does feel like a really definitive version of the story. And I'm wondering if you feel like, is this definitive? Is this the end of it? Mm-hmm. Can you close a chapter here somehow, or does it not feel that settled yet?
You know, I think it's a, you know, the show is a dramatization, not a documentary. And it's, you know, 10 episodes that I always joke, like if they had put me in charge of the 10 episodes, they would have all been about my first day of my internship. like I'm so detail oriented and this and that. And I would, you know, and I was often saying, well, what about this person who did this and that? And they're like, Monica, like, you know, one of the things I learned of just an audience can't hold that many characters, you know? Yeah. So I think that there's, you know, there was so much emotional truth in the series, and it captured so much. And I hope it leaves people with a better understanding of not only what happened to many of us at that time, but also what we experienced. And a lot of the personal work I've had to do over the years that really was what led up to my Vanity Fair essay in 2014 mm-hmm. was around reframing for myself this recognition that I couldn't run away anymore from what happened. Yeah. There was no putting 1998 Monica Lewinsky in a box and shipping her off into some far universe and starting over. And so the personal work that I had to do that was fucking hard was around integrating that. And so mm-hmm. I think for me, it is, and I also, you know, you also see with the story, I don't think anybody would have thought, you know, 20 plus years ago, oh, it's still going to be, even, you know, without the series, right? It's still going to come up in conversation. It will yeah. still be a cultural touch point. I don't think anybody would have put money on that. Mm-hmm. And so for me, you know, where I had to get comfortable is just this story is a part of our cultural, like, tapestry. And as society changes, it changes, you know, it's not where I'm focused. It's not where I want to focus. I'm very fortunate to have a first look deal with 20th Television for, you know, and that's where my focus is on telling other people's stories at the moment. But I just don't, I don't know if the chapter will ever be closed on this. I don't know, you know, so I think it's like silly to try and speculate at this 20 plus years on, you know, it just is like, I'm not sure that's a, like, yeah, sure. That's the nice answer that I would love to be able to give. But I think that version, the version of that answer is the same as Monica saying, I'll be okay at the end of, you know, 10.
Yeah. That's the best way to think of it. I mean, so in telling other people's stories, you have, you know, use your lived experience, as you were saying, to kind of reflect on people living through these moments of public humiliation. Does that feel like you're expanding that lens? Like, are you telling a wider range of stories? You know, it's been almost 10 years since that Vanity Fair essay. You're kind of expanding in so many different directions.
Yeah.
Well, okay,
I'm so
like
grateful.
Not there
right,
yet.
Right, seven, I know. But
yeah, what's the focus? Like, what is the broadening out of your focus from here?
I think that there's, you know, I'd probably say that there's kind of this, it seems there's a nucleus of ideas I'm drawn to that are around, you know, telling stories, whether it's someone's story we thought we knew and seeing it through a different angle or lens or perspective, or re-examining an issue through a story is also really interesting to me. But I also have a wider range. I mean, like, I'm super interested in space. I'm interested in spy things. So there's just kind of a wide range of things that I'm interested in. But I think it is about trying to tap into the unique experiences I've had and how that's shaped my lens for storytelling. So it's I'm really excited, and it's nice that the decks are kind of cleared with these two projects, and now all I really get to focus on is sort of these is future forward in telling other people's stories and different kinds of stories. So
when we get your space spy thriller, like, that sounds great.
I know.
I don't know when you're making that, but
exactly.
Bring it on, please. I think that's a good place to end it. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
for
Katie.
For taking the Okay, so I mostly want Monica to have the last word, but any closing thoughts on impeachment? I have enjoyed watching and talking about this series so much. I really hope more people get to watch it. You know, its ratings have been fairly well publicized as being lower than I think many of us might have hoped, but it'll be on Netflix eventually. You know, if people have listened to this and want to sell their friends on it, like, do we hope this has a kind of a growing legacy as the years go by?
Well, isn't there an interesting kind of parallel or echo there where it's like many of us could only reconsider the Lewinsky story with the distance of time and sort of perspective, and now hopefully once this thing is on Netflix other people can consider the show, you know.
Yeah.
I know it's all has to do with broadcast rights and legal stuff about why Impeachment was not readily available on Hulu, for example, you know, where people could watch it who don't have like broadcast cable or whatever. So yeah, I hope, you know, if you listen to this and watch the show and liked it, and then someone you know says, oh, I'm a few months from now that they're watching on Netflix, point them to us, because lots of great interviews and all that stuff.
I know, I'm looking forward to Sarah Paulson's turn at the Emmys next time around for this character.
Yeah, I really, God knows we'll get into Emmy speculation soon enough. I hope that the relatively low profile of this show doesn't prevent that from happening, because I'm hard pressed to imagine I'll see a better performance on TV between now and then, but we'll see. Well, that does it for Impeachment. Thank you again for joining us on this journey. You can still listen to Richard and Sonia on Succession, which is not a fun show, but I guess is more fun than Impeachment because it's terrible fake people.
It's all fake. That's the thing. You don't have to be like, well, but in real life, you know, it's all made up.
Well, yeah, because there are no bad, soulless rich people out there running the world in
reality.
Nope,
they're all good.
Absolutely. And please, if you haven't yet, read Julie's many great pieces about impeachment on VF.com. And email stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear your wrap-up thoughts on the series, even if we will not have another impeachment episode. And you can sign up on Subtext to hear from us about Succession from now on. Go to joinsubtext.com/stillwatching or text 213-652-6717. Other than that, Richard, where can people find you?
Well, I'm starting a business that makes period appropriate kitchens for shows set in the 90s.
Yeah.
Because I just cannot stand. There were not islands
what and, you were born to do.
And granite countertops in the same way. There were not farmhouse sinks and accepted real farmhouses. But other than that, I will be tweeting at Rylaws and writing at VF.com.
Julie, how about you?
I am tweeting from at Julie W. Miller.
And I will be busily reconstructing my own TV set that looks like Dragnet meets Star Trek. It's my dream. And Richard, your show can help me build that too, I think.
While wearing the Samantha hat.
Obviously. And I am tweeting at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. And as always, thank you to our editor and producer, Dave Gonzalez.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.